Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. This episode's a little different to our usual format in that it's a crossover show in collaboration with the Yacht Business Podcast, which is hosted by my friend and colleague, David Fuller. On the Yacht Business Podcast, David examines new innovative technologies, trends, and business models that are having an impact on the global marine industry. And in this episode, which will also be published on the Yacht Business Podcast, available on all major podcasting platforms, we chat about how various technologies have been having an effect on the professional yacht racing world. David Fuller, we're doing something a bit different this week. This is going to go out on both my podcast and your podcast. Let's start by just explaining who we are for our respective audiences. I'm Justin Chisholm. I'm a yachting journalist, and we've known each other for a little while now through various projects, our passion for sailing. And I've been running the Yacht Racing Podcast for, a few years now, kind of on and off, but gained a bit of momentum in the last year or so. So, David, introduce yourself.
So I'm David Fuller. I'm a part-time sailing media person, I guess. I used to write quite a lot. I had a relatively successful blog called Yacht Sponsorship, which was focused on the commercial side of the sport, and that's kind of where I got in, how I got into it, and where I focused. I was much less about the what the wind was blowing and who was first at the top mark, and a bit more around the commercial side. And I walked away from that for various reasons, and I guess we'll can get into that. And now I've restarted a new podcast, which I'm calling Yacht Business, which is focused on similar things, but I'm also looking at how emerging or disruptive technology impacts the space, the marine industry in general, but also professional sailing, which is how we got together and got to know each other.
You have a pretty strong technical background as well. Just talk a little bit about that, because I kind of regard you as a bit of a guru when it comes to blockchain and these various technologies that have emerged recently. And I consult with you fairly regularly to put me straight.
Yeah, so I guess digital technology as opposed to, you know, materials technology or engineering technology, I certainly, you know, can't compete with anyone who's talking about the nitty-gritty design paths of America's Cup boats, but certainly my background is marketing and business. And, you know, since the internet existed, since I saw that Mosaic first displayed at my university way back in, you know, the early 90s, I've had a passion for how digital technology can be used from a media point of view and from a communications, I guess generally from a communications point of view. So whether that means, you know, social media, or whether that means a YouTube channel, or now as you say, moving into more what they're now calling Web3, which is sort of blockchain and other technologies around that, whether it be the Internet of Things or 5G internet or machine learning or these types of digital technologies. That's kind of where I like to play.
things like the metaverse. The last time we spoke was for you to kind of clue me in, I think, on the metaverse and how that might affect things. I don't think we came to any strong conclusions, but that's a looming technology, isn't it?
The metaverse is fairly ill-defined at the moment. And, you know, there's lots of people who have an idea as to what they think the metaverse is. Originally, the word was coined by an author called Neil Stephenson, who mentioned the word first in a book called Snow Crash. And I don't think what his version of it was, even though he's building his own metaverse now, he's got his own company and is building his own version of the metaverse. So for some people, it's just a game. It's like an immersive VR game. For some people, it's a bit more like Second Life. I'm not sure if you ever come across that particular space, but as a virtual world that people could literally have a second virtual life. And you know, for others it's this, I guess the end goal is this sort of holodeck style reality, where you know, exist in a 3D world, a bit like Ready Player One or the Star Trek holodeck, but we're nowhere near that yet. I think the metaverse right now is a sort of a mainly a gaming space. But there are some really interesting applications for it in education. And there's also some very interesting applications for it in the healthcare sector. And so, you know, I think there will be some user cases that will come to pass. How it relates to the marine industry, I'm really not too sure.
So here's my view of how it might exist, how I'd like it to evolve is I've worked a lot with the Ocean Race over the years, the Volvo Ocean Race as it was. We got very excited about 3D cameras on the boats that could give us this immersive view of what it was like to be blasting along on a Volvo 70 or a VO65 in the Southern Ocean and spray everywhere. And you could almost picture yourself standing in the cockpit. That's what I want the metaverse to do for me. I want to be on the back of that boat. I want to be standing next to Ben Ainslie on his AC-75 as he wins the next America's Cup. Is there any chance of that, do you think?
It could be possible, I guess. I don't know how you'd render it, but the graphics engines are getting better and better. I know that Volvo actually had a simulator, didn't they? One of these sort of capsules that you could get into, and it would spray water on your face and throw you around as you watch the film.
It was kind of like the Disney World experience or Warner Brothers experience, where you jump into the Back to the Future car and go zooming over buildings and stuff. Funnily enough, I never actually got in it, but people who did really enjoyed the experience. And yeah, it did used to like spray with a little water, but not quite like the fire hose in the cruise used to get, I suspect.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think that's a possibility, but we're a way off, and the processing power probably needs to come up a bit. Most of the metaverses that are around at the moment are pretty clunky. Low resolution, pixelated sort of experiences. You'll need 5G or better in order to, you know, stream something like the Volvo Ocean Race or the America's Cup in anything close to real time. We'll see. I mean, I think more interestingly, I've actually asked some questions around how weather in the metaverse would work, for example, whether it would even have weather. And if it did, you know, what climate would you have? Does the whole metaverse have the same climate, or does it have the climate of where you are in the real world? There's some interesting questions around that. Although I know that there are scientific projects going on at the moment, that there's a digital twin of the oceans that I think the EU are trying to build. They're trying to, you know, take data that's from the real world and mirror the oceans in order to, you know, make simulations to predict what weather systems might look like in the future, or what marine life, you know, might look like in the future, or, you know, whether the seaweed will continue to grow or whether the fish will die and all that sort of stuff. So I think, again, if you take away the sort of consumer gaming element of some of these technologies and apply them specifically to, you know, research or something like that, then maybe a metaverse has more application for that. And maybe you know more about this than me, that I'm sure that the America's Cup teams are using simulators, aren't they?
They are, for sure. And that phrase digital twin, I want to come back to in a sec, because I hear that now a lot from the America's Cup teams from a design point of view when they're creating the boats. But David, I think we're maybe getting ahead of ourselves here. We've kind of leapt into the future. What we talked about doing was exploring a little bit just how technology has already influenced the sport of sailing. And I think we're really looking at the professional end of things here, because that's always been my focus. And, you know, one way that I saw it impact was when I sat down with the weather router for the Ocean Race, Gonzalo Infante, and I interviewed him for a piece about, you know, how do you plan the route of the next race, and they basically ran, you know, masses and masses and masses of simulations to try and make sure that the boats could arrive in a stopover port in a feasible time scale, because obviously there's forward planning that goes into all of these stopovers. And, you know, I imagine it was running on his laptop, but, you know, in reality, it was running on a massive, I would have called it mainframe back in the day, but I guess it's a massive cloud of computing power that IBM were providing. And they'd actually bought, I think, at that stage, weather.com. And he said it just allowed him to do so much more and be so much more precise. Do you remember that happening? Or
yeah, I think that that there's sort of a bunch of technologies that have enabled that, including IoT. So sensors, for example, have become a lot smaller and they use less battery power, so you can put more of them out there in more places. And you know, again, satellite technology, the amount, you know, you can actually bring that data back from wherever it's being recorded, and so you have a lot more, you have a lot more data, and you have a lot more tools to be able to process that data. So, you know, you would think that, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago or longer, you would have a number of very large, expensive weather stations that were collecting information, and perhaps not being able to collate that in a way that that all made sense. Whereas now, you know, you've got thousands. I was talking to someone last week about a project called Yachts for Science, and there's 13,000 super yachts in the world. Now, each one of those super yachts has sensors on it that, that can, you know, record or sense weather data. And if you can collate that, then suddenly you've got so many more data points than you used to. Or you've got history from the Sydney Hobart Yacht Race, or you've got history from the Round the World Race, or you've got history from the record attempts. And you can put all that together into a model, and you've got a lot more, if you've got the processing power, as you say. You've got a lot more data points, and therefore, I guess you've got a much better accuracy from your for your forecasts.
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly I was always amazed with the Ocean Race that Gonzalo was able to, you know, give very accurate predictions of when boats were going to arrive into ports, you know, even 2 weeks ahead of time. And I guess he was working with the Polar, you know, I mean, guess it got easier with the advent of the one design boats, because then it was only one Polar he was looking at for the VO65s. And that was the second race, I think. So it would be starting to get pretty accurate by that point.
That's kind of interesting. I remember listening to Russell Coutts talk about the giant trimaran that Oracle had. And I remember him telling a story of the engineers telling him that he wasn't going fast enough, that he was, you know, that they knew exactly how fast the boat could go in a certain wind condition or a certain wave, you know, wave state. And he was sort of jokingly sort of saying that these engineers had never actually stepped foot on the thing, and they didn't realize just how scary it was as it creaked and got up to speed. You know, their model was telling them that he could push it further, and he was like, every bone in his body was saying, there's no way I can go any faster.
Yeah, I've got the reverse of that story, a personal sailing experience, sailing at Cowes Week, the year that Silk did its massive nosedive. We had 50 knots of breeze while the fleet was out racing, and we were sailing a Humphreys 30, designed by Rob Humphreys, and he was on board. And we went round the Windward Mark, took off across the Solent with a reef in the main, which was the most reefs we could put in, the smallest headsail we had up. And I forget what speed we were doing, but we was a lot faster than we'd ever been. And he turned to me and he said, it's not supposed to go this fast. And I said, Rob, that's not helpful right now. So that was the reverse.
Back when speed was determined by waterline length.
Absolutely. It was a fascinating, exciting day out. But just going back to Gonzalo, I mean, the significance of him being able to predict that accurately meant that it wasn't just convenient for everybody to know when the boats were coming in. The race organization were booking flights based on his information, were booking hotel rooms based on his information. So there was a risk to all this. There was a risk that the right people wouldn't be there if he got it wrong. So good use of that technology.
Well, I think that's also interesting in our field, sort of, to bring it round to the comms side of things and the media side of things. They must be using that type of predictive technology for TV schedules, for example, to know when to run a race so that, it fits within the TV window. Or if they know that the Sunday is going to be really calm, they'll bring it forward. And I'm thinking of something like SailGP here. I know that they've, raced on a Friday and a Saturday, knowing that the wind is not necessarily going to be there on the Sunday. So, these types of predictions and forecasts impact every aspect of the show.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you're right about SailGP. There's probably a few people listening who will moan and groan about SailGP's ability or inability to get that right. There's been a few occasions, I think, where in Denmark, there was no racing on the Saturday, and nobody could understand why they didn't go to the Friday. And but it's more complicated than just that.
So you say I was an early adopter, but I think you're more of an early adopter than me when it comes to some of these things. So you had a podcast really early on. You've dabbled with things like e-magazines on iPads. You've played around with all kinds of different media to get to your audience. So go back to how's the podcasting changed since the really early days when you were doing it?
Well, I think let me answer a different question first of all. I think my job as a sailing journalist, the way I do my job has changed dramatically since I kind of reinvented myself a long time, 20 odd years ago, as a sailing journalist. And back then, you could, if you were good enough, you could pitch a magazine editor, of which there were plenty, and say, hey, I'm thinking about going to cover the Melges 24 Worlds. It's going to be down at Key West. And you could get a commission from them, which would pay enough to fly out there, stay in a hotel, not a particularly swanky one, cover the event and still make some money out of it. Now, those days changed pretty quickly. The magazine industry globally has taken a massive hit, and there are so few sailing magazines left now, and the ones that pay any money are even fewer. So that meant a complete switch around for me, that I needed to be able to interview people, not so much cover events, but I needed to be able to interview the key players in the sport. And of course, the advent of things like Skype, and we're going back a long way here, but it kind of changed everything, because suddenly I could interview Russell Coutts in New Zealand when I was sitting at home in the UK, and I could write those stories, and it immediately changed just everything. So I think that even those kind of what we regard now as basic technologies have made a big change to the way sailing communications works. And it's not just me. Everybody has been able to benefit from that. But certainly, yes, I'm a bit of a techie geek. I love my gadgets. I love the iPad when it came out. I love the iPhone too. I love the idea of podcasting. And I kind of wanted in to all of that. So yeah, the podcast came first, which I did with a friend and colleague of mine, Andy Rice, which I'm sure listeners will know from his various writings and websites and whatever. And we started a podcast called Sailing Talk, and it was just the two of us talking for 15 minutes each week, and just what did we think, We would pick a topic and we would talk about it, maybe an event that just happened, maybe somewhere we'd been. David, whether anybody ever listened to it, I have no idea, because back then you really had no statistics.
Right.
And we did it really as a calling card. It was a business card for us to say, hey, we're two sailing journalists and we kind of think we know what we're talking about enough to do this. And again, whether that ever benefited us, I'm not entirely sure. The iPad magazine was a really interesting thing for me, and I was in kind of in disbelief that when the iPad came out and the technologies emerged that you could, somebody like me could produce a an interactive magazine on the iPad, and everything on the iPad was cool back then, right? It all looked fantastic. The photographs looked amazing because the resolution was better than anything else at that point. And I was able to do it. And I thought, oh, I it can't be just me. There must be all of these big magazines must be doing exactly what I'm doing. And I spoke to Matt Sheehan one day and I showed him what I was producing. And he burst out laughing and he said, oh, he said, I've been trying to persuade Yachting World to do this for years, and you're going to steal a march on everybody. So my idea, I know I'm talking a lot here, but my idea was to be less of a writer and more of an editor. And I recruited Bob Fisher and Andy Rice and a few other of the sailing journalists, and they wrote monthly columns for me.
I think I even wrote you something once in the day.
You absolutely did. Yeah, you wrote on the business side of things. So two things I learned from it. One, it was incredibly popular. We had 100,000 downloads of the app, which is, you know, even by today's standard is a huge take up. That's when it was a free magazine.
Right.
And I tried various models of monetizing it through advertising and then through charging a subscription. And the reality is that I think it probably is possible to monetize that, but as a single individual trying to do everything, the workload was just too high.
Yeah, because I think even though the technology has moved on in many, many places, creating original content, good original content, is still time consuming and expensive and hard.
Yeah, it is. It is. And in the world that I wanted to play in the, you know, leaning towards the professional end of things, finding the people to write for you that are expert enough to do it and being able to afford them is an expensive. So that was Sail Racing Magazine, and it lasted a few years. I had a few stumbles and restarts on it, and eventually decided to pull the plug, largely because I was offered roles with the Ocean Race and the America's Cup and various other things that were, you know, as a freelancer, the temptation to take a regular decent payment is, you know, you got to pay the bills, you got to pay the mortgage and put food on the table. So, but I don't regret doing it. And I think it was well received at the time.
So I think that was the hardest part of all of this was the business model. You know, the sailing, professional sailing fan base is not massive. You know, it's, you look at all the social media likes, and I think, you know, you're lucky if you're getting into the hundreds of thousands. You know, it's certainly still a niche sport, and from that point of view, there's also a limited number of advertisers. You know, there's a limited number of watch companies or, you know, bits. So the advertising model is sort of tough, especially if you're coming to it new, like I was. I mean, you at least had some track record and reputation, whereas when I started my first blog, I was completely unknown. And I had traffic, but I didn't have the way the advertising model worked was that it was based on views and numbers rather than the quality of the people who were looking at the site. And that was one of the reasons that I stopped it, just because I couldn't make it work from a business model point of view. And I think that has changed in the last few years with whether it's Patreon or whether it's, you know, some other type of donation mechanic, or whether it's some sort of subscription mechanic that's now everyone has Apple Pay and everyone's used to paywalls, because everyone from the New York Times to the FT has now got a paywall. So it was assumed by many fans that the content we were producing should be free. They weren't necessarily in a place to pay for it, whereas I think that's changed now, and there are more people who are willing to pay a couple of bucks here or there, or to, you know, subscribe for a few pounds a month to get access to the content that they want. Have you found, is that ring true for you as well?
Yes, and I think you said something interesting. You said it was niche, you know, sailing's niche. And what I've learned is that niche can be good.
Yeah.
Because niches are where people have passion for something. And when they have passion for it, if they're getting good content, they're often willing to pay for it. Whereas I think the more general you go, the more mainstream you go, then people, they don't have that passion. It's too broad. So that's certainly what I've been focusing on recently. I mean, the yacht racing podcast is an unashamedly me interviewing people that I find interesting in the sport. There are certain people who I've not interviewed, and it's because I just don't think they're going to be an interesting interview. And it's not because they haven't done anything interesting. Often they have, but some people, you know, they're just not good with interviews and
right.
Personality wise. And it's kind of unfair to ask them to do it.
Sure.
But that's been extremely well received. Again, I've explored charging for it. I've given in and gone back to a free model. And I guess it's my kind of my contribution to the sailing communication world is we're going to put that out there. And it was interesting. I mean, it was a good year or so after I started that Shirley Robertson and Tim Butt started with their podcast. And Tim said, "Oh, we're going into competition with you." And I said, "There is no competition in this market. It's the more people who are doing this at a high level, at a decent level, the better, you know, because
yeah,
then
absolutely.
People get used to the idea of sailing podcasts. Just because somebody listens to mine doesn't mean they won't listen to yours and vice versa. They almost certainly will listen to,
yeah,
to both,
and it's a different style. I mean, I don't listen to it all the time, but I occasionally listen to Barkarati, which is the three guys in Australia, which
sure.
is a very different podcast altogether because it's
absolutely.
You know, three hosts and they're talking about the Australian market a lot more than, you know, sailing. It's got a completely different season. You know, it happens in December in, you know, in Sydney Harbour,
yeah.
not in May.
And I love the fact that those guys, and I know all three of them, I love the fact that they're doing that because that's a bit more, that's what sailing didn't really have. It's a bit more like the traditional podcast, mainstream podcast model where it's a group of guys kind of bantering. And I think it's great because we didn't have that before. Alan Block probably was the closest to it with his, I don't know whether he did call it Sailing Anarchy or whether it was the Alan Block podcast. And that was a bit more like that. It was a bit more free form. But yeah, I've adopted a model where I just interview them. I do very little editing. If I only edit out coughing fits or occasionally if somebody swears, and I think I've got to be careful with Apple Podcasts because I don't want to get tagged as adult only content because I'm
yeah.
sure we have some younger listeners, but I don't do a massive amount of editing. I let the interviews, I put the effort into making the interviews strong on the day by preparing the right questions and researching the guests. And I think that's what Shirley does really well with her podcast as well.
Yeah. But I think it also, there's still a lack of diversity in the comms, isn't there? I mean, there's mostly white guys that are in this business. You know, there's a few women, but there used to be Pierre, you know, had his blog in Spain. And that was incredibly
Valencia
popular
sailing,
just because
yeah.
it was, you know, for a different language in different languages and whatever else. Well, France, I guess there's a lot of coverage. I don't speak French, so I don't listen to any of that or watch any of that.
Yeah. Well, the guys have done well in France with the Tip and Shaft podcast. That's an unfortunate name, but you know they created a newsletter model before really I'd even heard of the newsletter model. And it's very brief. It's just headlines really more than anything else. It's, I would imagine, relatively easy to create on a weekly basis because there's a little bunch of them. Whether they're making a success out of it financially, I really don't know because, you know, how could you know? All of us are quite secretive about that sort of stuff.
I think
they seem to have a good subscriber base because it says at the bottom how many subscribers there are.
Well, I think the thing that really pushed changed the game for people like us was social media, in the sense that you could suddenly get distribution a lot more easily than you used to be able to. I mean, you driving traffic to a website was always expensive or hard. You know, the discovery was relatively difficult for people to discover new media or new sites or whatever. But social media, and I started my blog around the same time that Twitter started, and built a massive following on Twitter, which enabled me to effortlessly sort of send out a ping that said, hey, there's a new article up on the website, or you know, there's a new piece of content out there. And that model worked incredibly well in terms of building a understanding who the sailing audience was. And I guess it also was a massive boon for rights holders, who could suddenly talk directly to their fans without having to go through the magazines or the newspapers or the TV stations, or hoping that, you know, they'd get picked up by the news. They could just open the channel directly to the fans, which was a game changer.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what we're seeing more and more of now with things like Substack, which is a newsletter stroke website platform that allows writers of any genre to be able to connect directly with an audience and to monetize it really easily. They have a payment system built into the whole thing. And that's the route I've gone down with a website newsletter called Cup Insider about the America's Cup, and the same thing for SailGP, another one called SGP Insider. And, you know, really, again, it's I think sometimes the trick is being the first one to do it. And I think I am the first one on Substack. I did notice that Richard Gladwell has his own site set up. It's not active yet, but Richard from SailWorld, who I have, you know, a huge amount of respect for. So I think people are going to cotton on to that as well. But, you know, maybe being the first one in is a help. Because the other goal
is there a subscription or a charge for that as a content creator?
They take a little fee that you don't pay anything to them directly. They take a fee from
what it's a commission if you're getting subscriptions. They're taking a thing. I've never liked those sites, just because I like having control of my content, and so I have run my, and I'm technically proficient enough to be able to run my own websites and build my own websites. So if I can control the domain and the SEO keep control of the content, then I prefer that than a model like Substack. But
which I would agree with you. But you're a bit of a rare case in that you've got that technical knowledge, and I just don't, you know. And it's expensive to find, and it's time consuming. And the thing I like about these models is it just lets you write. You focus on the writing. But what I've also found is that you write in a slightly different way, because you are writing for an audience of people who have subscribed either for free or as a paid subscription. And you feel that kind of personalizes it. You feel a responsibility towards them. I think sometimes you write a bit more often and longer than you might do normally.
Yeah. Well, my old site, I used to know the people who read it by name. I mean, like,
exactly. Exactly.
So I was almost writing directly to a certain person when I was editorializing about someone I had in mind who was reading it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I get an email every time somebody signs up, and I always open the email and look. Nine times out of ten, I don't know who it is. But it's, I don't know. It's interesting to me just to see that.
Given that sailing is something that people are passionate about, why is there not more YouTube channels or more Substacks or more TikToks around sailing? Is it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer. I mean, Matt Sheehan's doing really well with his Planet World YouTube channel. Again, we don't know how much he's been able to monetize that, but I understand he's certainly working really hard on it, and he's got, from what I can see, a high subscriber base for sailing. in YouTube terms generally. I don't think it's going to break any records. And that, you know, that's a kind of highly professionally produced channel. And then you've got, you know, you've got other people, like there's a guy that's on Sailing Anarchy a lot.
Mozzie's just restarted his channel. Mozzie, I think 12 days ago, yeah. he's just restarted his YouTube channel. So
yeah, which is a,
interestingly enough, now if you can hover over the bottom of the video and you can see where people are tuning in and tuning out.
Right.
Which I did for SailGP the other day. It's quite interesting. You get this huge spike at the start of the race and then nothing, and then another spike at the start of the next race and then nothing.
Yeah. That's what I've heard. And I mean, I think with the Mozzie Sails thing, it's interesting. I mean, he's something like 18,000 subscribers on his YouTube channel, which, you know, it's not.
I think you've got to carve out something different. Right. And he's done that. He's focusing on the engineering, technical design piece, which a lot of people love geeking out on. You know, even I, who don't necessarily understand it, I still like to geek out on some of the videos that he does. Because I find them really, really interesting. You know, again, the reason I did mine the way, well, because I know the commercial side, that's why I can write about the commercial side, because that's what I'm into. But you can only have so many generic kind of stories. And, you know, to a certain degree, even though you and Shirley are very different and your podcasts are very different, there's only so many people that you can talk to without hearing, you know, John Bertrand's story again, or Nick.
Absolutely.
You
know, absolutely.
Or Ben Ainsley's story again, or someone else's story again. It's the origin story over and over again.
Yeah, exactly. And I get an email from Shirley when she's produced an episode, and I see who it is, and I'm like, oh, well, I need to cross them off the list of people I was going to interview, because that's a waste of time. You know, you can't do that for another couple of years at least. So what's interesting about the podcast is, though, I mean, I think I've got 60 episodes up right now. And even though I haven't put an episode out, this will be the first one for a little while. The take up's still really strong on the back issues on the previous editions, which I think makes me happy, because I tried to make them timeless. I mean, you know, other than the Vendée Globe things I did with Conrad Coleman, everything else you could listen to it at any point and it would still be pretty relevant, because it's just stories about how people came into the professional sailing world. So that's pleasing. Just looking at the time a little bit, I want to quiz you on digital twin. Can you give us a 1 minute explanation or shorter of what a digital twin is?
Yeah,
it's going to be big in the America's Cup.
Yeah, so a digital twin is kind of what it sounds like. It's a virtual or digital model of a physical thing. So, for example, if you have a boat. And I had a really interesting podcast a couple of weeks ago with a guy called Johnny Dodge, who is in the super yacht business. But he was talking about how there's a yacht yard, St. Lorenzo, I think he said, that build big super yachts. They have now in their shipyard an enormous green screen building, green walls, and they put the goggles, VR goggles, on the face of the buyer, of the owner. And they walk them through a 3D real scale model of the boat before it's ever built. So that they can see where things are laying, how they're laid out, and you can see how big the master cabin is, and you can, you know, work it all out. Literally walk through a 3D replica of the boat before it's ever been built. Which saves a lot of money and time and money. If you build a twin of your boat, you know, in a digital world, and you can put it into a physics engine, you know, apply gravity, apply friction, apply whatever the forces are to it, and then you can tinker with it. So you can say, okay, so it's basically a model, a simulated 3D digital model of a real world thing. And I can imagine that it's probably been used in yacht design for a while. The cool one now is what they're talking about is a digital triplet. And so a digital twin is an absolute mirror of the physical physical thing. The digital triplet and now is got a machine learning AI attached to it that learns from the twin, so that the triplet kind of watches the twin and then suggests changes based on a machine learning AI model, and then that can be then applied to the twin, and then that can be applied to the physical thing. It's
Where is that being used? Probably outside of sailing. Where has that evolved from that?
So that it's like manufacturing systems, for example. So what they're calling it, manufacturing 4.0 or industry 4.0. So yeah, for example, if you've got a production line, you've got your physical production line in the factory, and then you've got your your digital twin of the production line, so you can see that running. And then you create the triplet, which basically the machine learning watches the digital twin and says, oh, actually, I'm going to see what happens if I take three people off this production line for 10 minutes and then see what happens. Or I'm going to add, you know, a new machine to this production line and see what happens. So if you're designing processes that have variables, and again, you know, sailboats have a lot of variables. But you know, if you can add or take away, change the conditions in the triplet as a kind of a, but I'm not explaining it very well. But it has this element of machine learning and AI attached to it, whereas the digital twin is more of a, I'll make a physic, me as a human being will make a change in the digital twin to see what happens. But yes, the triplet is actually an artificial intelligence machine learning, yes, doing that change as opposed to a human.
Now you've mentioned artificial intelligence and machine learning. We talked about this on our preparation call a little bit, but I just wanted to flag it up as a cool technology that's been used in the marine world. So the company was originally called Oscar, and it's just changed into CSEA.AI. That's the name of the company, CAI. And this is a company that produces the kit that the Imoca boats used in the Vendée Globe to look ahead of them during the day and at night and spot objects in the water, which the skipper, even if he was looking out 24 hours a day, you know, might not be able to spot. So it's not
like a container or a whale.
Absolutely, and that's exactly the example they use. And you know, there's some fantastic testimonies from Jean Le Cam and people like that who helped develop the whole thing. So it's kind of what we always said, like, isn't there a system where these boats can stop running into things, because you know, this seems crazy. Well, now the technology seems to have caught up with that, and of course it can be applied to super yachts, it can be applied to any vessel now. But what was interesting for me was that the fact that it's learning from every time a system is installed, as I understand it, what that system learns gets fed back into the total system.
Right. So the more times it sees a whale, the more times it says that is a whale. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I mean, it's probably an interview I need to do, or maybe you need to do further down the line, and just find out, like, how did they build the database that it's running from now? Because you know, you look at the Google cars, we all know they spent a long time teaching them traffic lights and various other things, pedestrians and pedestrian crossings.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's very interesting. Although I think it can go too far. I don't know what your thoughts are on the new AC40 that seems like it could basically be sailed by remote control.
Yeah, I've talked to a few people about this, including some America's Cup sailors. And I think what you're talking about is the video that the Emirates Team New Zealand produced with Nathan Outeridge basically talking us through how this AC40 works. And of course, we get excited and say, all right, well, yeah, sit in the cockpit, show me what's in the cockpit. And it was kind of just a set of buttons. It was a steering wheel and a set of buttons. And I still think the boat is ultra cool, and I love everything that's going on with the foiling monohulls. But I was a bit, yeah, there are no ropes on this boat at all. And it just kind of brought it home for me that, yeah, it's become a push button sport. at that level. So
yeah.
What was your thought?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you could basically just, as I say, sail it via remote control. You wouldn't even have to have a skipper necessarily on board. They do drone racing these days, so I'm sure you could do, you know, remote control boats. Although that's been around for a long time as well, remote control boats, remote control sailboats.
Well, the other big area of this is that's probably contentious and will aerate the social media channels is the ocean race. The Amok is now, fully crewed, which is only four people, but that's what fully crewed is these days. But the boats will largely be steered by autohelm. So they're foiling boats. They're traveling at high speed, you know, in the right conditions. And it's a big departure for the race to allow autohelms. And originally they weren't going to do it. The autohelms were going to be there for use when you were doing sail changes. So just a heading control. But now they've adopted what was developed for the Vendée Globe, these highly sophisticated robot systems, as the skippers are now calling them, that can steer the boat pretty much as well as a human can. And Will Harris, who's sailing with Boris Herman on the Militia project, he said that, you know, there will be somebody with the autohelm control in their hand, and that is what will pass for helming the boat during this race. So it's interesting, you know, and I guess the point is that the boats are so high performance now that that's what you have to do.
You could probably get to a point where you'd say that the that an auto helm would be better than a human.
Because
it just can process a lot more data, a lot more quickly. The human brain is not very good at that sort of thing. If you've got IoT sensors on the tips of the foils and on the tips of the rudders and on the top of the mast, and you've got all that data being fed into a robot that's saying, "Well, I'm going to correct by half a degree," that a human probably can't even work it out. On a wheel or a tiller, how much to correct without having overcorrecting and undercorrecting. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And in the Vendée Globe, I mean, the autohelm steers about 95% of the race. That was a big shock to me when I found that out a few years ago. But the systems are so advanced now that they absolutely can steer way better than the sailors, and especially over prolonged periods. The sailors are really there as caretakers of the boat, I think, in the Vendée, which is I'll probably get a slap from one of the skippers for saying that, but essentially they're there to do all the stuff that a robot couldn't.
Interesting. Yeah, it does it does bring it into question what why you're doing it, right?
Yeah.
Why people are following it.
Well, that's right. And it'll be interesting to see this time around what the response of the sailing public is to these Imoca boats where the crews are enclosed. Kind of getting off our technological topic a little bit there. But let me drag it back then.
That machine learning for auto helms is definitely the sort of technology that will impact the sport as well. But
So let me drag it onto something else. We'll probably close with this one unless you've got anything else burning, but you and I have talked about DAOs, and I've forgotten what it is, something autonomous.
Decentralized doodickies. Autonomous organization.
Yeah, so DAOs are a big thing. It's all linked in with blockchain, but we're going to have a DAO sailing team in SailGP if we believe their marketing hype. I know you're cynical. So
I'm not cynical. I think the idea of an idea of a team that's owned by the fans is a pretty cool idea. I mean, the ultimate DAO is actually a sailing club. It's not a new idea, right? You know, a sailing club is effectively a DAO. It's got members. It's got a committee that's voted for by the members. You know, it's an entity that is it's sort of got a democratic structure to it, operates to a constitution or a set of policies. So there are real world facsimiles of DAOs. The difference with the DAO, which I think is a bunch of techies looking for a solution, is that It's based on NEAR protocol, so I'm assuming you need to hold the NEAR token in order to participate. And does that mean that if somebody has 80% of the tokens, they get 80% of the votes, in which case it's, you know, not, what's the point?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a lot of question marks around it. Not necessarily cynical, skeptical, shall we say.
Skeptical, there we go. We'll go for skeptical. But it seems like a good way of raising money, doesn't it? I mean, potentially you could raise a lot of money very quickly for a SailGP team.
Yes. Again, you've got to work out whether or not there's any overlap between the people who have blockchain or cryptocurrency wallets and understand how loading a cryptocurrency wallet using normal dollars or pounds or euros into that wallet, then converting it to a NEAR token and then investing that into joining a DAO via Discord. It's an incredibly complicated and technical user journey. And whether or not the fans of SailGP match the people who are comfortable with that user journey remains to be seen.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, I love the fact that they're trying it. It's great that it's our sport that's trying these sort of things. And we can be skeptical. I agree. We shouldn't be cynical.
Is trying a similar kind of thing. I think there's a golf token and a sort of a golf blockchain golf club. And I'd be surprised if, maybe for some of the football clubs would be looking into it. But, you know, every single Grand Prix, every single Formula One team has a crypto partner. You know, there's certainly a lot that's going on in that space. Again, probably not the cryptocurrency side, but more of the blockchain side. So it's a technology that's certainly going to impact in ways we probably haven't even considered or thought of yet.
So what have we missed on this chat? We're running up about 52 minutes now, so that's probably as long as people really want to bear.
I think that's the most. I think that's it for now. The only thing I was going to cover off was the bit we talked about the other day about rights holders' attitudes to independent media people, but we can leave that. It's not that interesting.
No, tell me.
Okay, no, so I was going to say that I think, you know, one of the things that technology changed from a media side of things was somebody didn't have to have the investment of starting a magazine or a printing press or having to buy a broadcasting license. You know, anybody could suddenly become a media personality or an influencer, blogger, however you want to define that. And it used to be that when I started my blog, there were certain rights holders that wouldn't recognize me as media. I had to say that I was working for the Times, or I had to say that I had a credential, or they wanted to know how many millions of people were looking at my website before they'd offer me a pass to the media center. And that slowly changed around that period. You know, certain rights holders, I think people like the Extreme Sailing Series, looking forward, sort of said, this is the future. This is the way we're going to get our message out there, is via these independent social media or bloggers. Certainly they were the first series that gave me credentials. It took the America's Cup a little bit longer. I'm not sure what your experience of that was like.
Yeah, I kind of went at it a slightly different way in that I had written part-time for some of the magazines for a couple of years. So I was lucky enough to have the kind of body of work, not that it was a big body of work, that I could I applied for a Yachting Journalists Association membership and got that, and once you've got that, accreditation gets a lot easier for sure. But yeah, I do remember early on struggling a little bit for credibility, which I think is fair. It's interesting to me that, just going back to Mozzie Sales, you know, he's been given access, and I think quite rightly, for the America's Cup Recon Cloud, which is a kind of limited number of media outlets have been given access to that. That only came about really because he wrote a rant on the Sailing Anarchy forum about, you know, basically how crap it was and how disappointed he was in the whole thing. And I think somebody approached him and said, well, you're only seeing a tiny fraction of it, and why don't you have a look? And of course, then he said, well, I've been given access now, and look, it's actually really cool. There's a lot of stuff on here. It just needs to be curated, which I think is a fair point. And he's going to do a good job of doing that. But, you know, he's a part-timer, you know, and this is, you know, should we be limiting these things to people who are full-time and doing it professionally? I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. I suspect as long as the quality is high and consistent, then you leave them to it.
Yeah. If he's got an audience, and then, you know, why not? Gets it out there. Absolutely.
It reminds me a little bit of the complaint from all of my photographer friends, because when I first started in this business, I made a point of making friends with the photographers, because as much as I pride myself on being a good writer, a good photo with your piece will enhance it massively. So, but they all complain that everybody's got a digital camera now. Like, everybody thinks they're a photographer. I guess it's a little bit the same as everybody's got a computer, everybody's got a keyboard, everybody thinks they can write. I think the number of people taking photographs has dropped off dramatically, because that's a difficult game to make any serious money in.
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess the business models have changed enormously as well. So, you know, again,
yeah.
You used to have this concept of, you know, if it's on the front cover of a big magazine and you got paid a certain amount, and is the hero image on the top of a blog article, you know, worth the same? It's a really interesting question, which I don't know I don't know the answer to.
Yeah, I think the way that whole photography model has changed is you're right. It used to be the cover shots, and now what you find is there's probably five, or maybe, if we're being generous, 10 photographers out there who are hired by the organization of the America's Cut, the Ocean Race, whatever it is. And part of their role is to distribute those images as widely, make them as widely available as possible.
Yeah.
So on a regular basis, I get a link sent to me in the email to Carlo Bolinghi's photos, or you know, any number of the other photographers whose names have immediately gone out of my head. Now I'm recording a podcast. But why would I consider paying for them? I mean, I'm getting them for free. Slightly different for the magazines, I think, but the model's just changed completely.
Interesting. Great.
All right, well, David, I think it's been interesting. Hopefully the listeners do too. It's a little bit of a departure for us to do this kind of cross-pollination.
A crossover episode.
yeah, it's been fun for me. So let's leave it at that. David, thanks a million for joining me, and I hope your audience enjoys hearing from me, and I'm sure my audience will enjoy hearing from you.
That's great, Justin. That's been a real pleasure.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks go to David Fuller for his expert perspective, and thanks to all of you also for listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another episode, but until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.